New York, we discovered Dialer Drug, which was a service that delivered whatever drug you wanted straight to your door. It seemed a bit strange to Sally and me, as we thought that the police would soon be onto it, but it seemed to work, and Sally got hold of some massive magic mushrooms. We decided to go to Area, the most fashionable club in town, to meet John Badham. We took the mushrooms and ordered a cab to take us there. We were very impressed by Area, the decor of which was changed every month, so that it always had a different theme. This was Bondage Month, and there were cages and bars everywhere. It was nothing like we'd ever seen in England. The crowd were older than the London clubbers and were far more sophisticated. We were out of it on the mushrooms and had drunk copious amounts of vodka and cran grape, which seemed to be the drink of the moment. Suddenly we saw a vision in silver come towards us and realised that it was Gary Glitter. Sally dropped to the floor and lay prostrate at his feet shouting, "Gary, Gary, Gary, I love you." I think he was glad to get the attention because he wasn't well known in America at the time. We were feeling so ill and drunk, we decided to go back to Charlie's. We drove them mad, falling all over the flat, screaming and shouting, and Sally threw up bright red sick all over the bathroom. The cran grape obviously did not agree with her. I have got fantastic photos of her with her head down the toilet covered with what looks like entrails, but which is really her own vomit. The shocking thing was that in the morning we crept into the bathroom dreading what we would find but found it spotless. In my drunken state I had managed to clear the whole mess up, which I could have never done sober. Sally returned to New York many times after this trip and became a major celebrity on the club scene. Since Sally had been diagnosed in 1988, she had been attending hospital regularly for checkups. She had originally gone to St. Mary's, but in about 1991 she decided that she did not like it there and decided to transfer to the Middlesex Hospital. The clinic arranged for Sally to have counselling, which she thoroughly enjoyed. She used to frighten the psychologist by saying that she worked for Sigmund Freud's grandson, and she would argue back with everything he said. We got into my car, and I had to describe the ward to Sally. I had visited several weeks earlier to see a friend. I told her it was a typical hospital ward with several alcoves, each with about 6 beds in them. There were a couple of single rooms at the end. I did not tell her about the air of despondency hanging over the place. However hard the nurses tried to be cheery, there was no getting away from the fact that all the people in this ward were going to die sooner rather than later. There was no hope of recovery or a miracle cure for any of them. Sally still managed to make a few jokes on the way to the hospital, and she said that she was pleased that at least she knew what was wrong with her, and was pretty confident that she would soon be cured of the meningitis. We arrived at Middlesex Hospital and made our way to the ward. We went to the desk and they asked us to wait in the television room while they arranged for the doctor to book Sally in. We sat in the horribly depressing television room, and I think this was the first time that Sally realised the implications of her illness. There was a very skinny man sitting in the room, trying to eat some pasta from a Tupperware box, but obviously finding it hard going. He picked up the box and shuffled out of the room. Sally buried her head in her hands, and there was a terrible, intense atmosphere in the room, as if there were too much electricity or not enough air. Everything seemed to buzz. Neither of us knew what to say, so we sat there in silence, until the nurse came in to tell us that the doctor was ready. Sally was given a bed, and the doctor came over and asked her lots of questions. He inquired about her symptoms, how long she'd been diagnosed, where she lived, what her lifestyle was. When the doctor asked Sally what floor she lived on, Sally looked concerned, as if the doctor was insinuating that she should live on the ground floor. She had really pulled herself together by now and told the doctor firmly that she did not intend that this disease would change her living arrangements or lifestyle at all. When he asked what her job was, she replied, "Performance artist." This rather raised the eyebrows of the doctor. The doctor then went off to sort out some medicine. Sally immediately asked me if I thought the doctor was gay, and did I fancy him. When I got back to the hospital that night, I could not believe my eyes. Sally was in the best mood ever, singing and dancing around her room in her usual garb of baggy chewing gum white Calvin Y fronts, saying she felt great. She was complimenting me, saying, "Oh, you look so great. Who made that beautiful jacket for you?" When I told her she'd made it, she looked awestruck and went on and on about what a great lady she was, so talented and so clever. She got back into bed and proceeded to tell me a long story about her sister being a foundling, and she was squashed into a little bit of land between Australia and Tasmania. This story took about half an hour to tell, and even as she was struggling to tell it, she knew it was rubbish. She kept saying, "We're going to have such a laugh tomorrow remembering this crap. God, morphine is a fantastic drug. No wonder people go mad for it." She continued telling jokes and dancing about all evening, and for once I had tears of laughter rolling down my cheeks instead of tears of despair. As the evening went on, she began to get more sleepy as more morphine got into her system. Every time the pump put a bit more into her, I could see her eyes roll as it kicked in. At about 11, she passed out, so I crept off home feeling much better about the whole situation. It was as if the old Sally had returned for a couple of hours. At 3:10 a.m. on New Year's Eve 1994, a couple of hours after I had returned from the hospital, Nicola called to say that Sally had just died. She had been struggling to stay alive until the end. She really didn't want to die, but in the end she just stopped breathing. I threw my clothes on and drove back to the hospital. It seemed so spooky and surreal. I went into the room to see her. She was lying on the bed, naked, with all the tubes and wires removed. She looked truly fantastic, just like herself, but empty. It wasn't her anymore. She made a glorious corpse. She still looked powerful and strong, and the illness had left no scars on her body. The homely nurse had placed one of Curl's gerberas in her hand to add a final poignant touch. Nicola, Tom, and I then went into a small office, the same one where we had met all the doctors, to be told of the arrangements that we had to make. Sally had told me that she wanted to go home to Australia to be buried with her mother, and if there was a service, she wanted no mention of God. Rachel Auburn summed up the thoughts of most of Sally's friends and admirers in her words, "I never met anyone like her, and I never will again. She was on a different level, with an incredible energy and dynamism. I miss her so much. I miss her phone calls. I miss talking to her. I miss her enthusiasm and encouragement." As Sally was such a liar, some friends still hope her dying was an incredibly elaborate hoax, the culmination of a life of pranks. If a tribe of natives are ever discovered in Papua New Guinea running around with pink faces and 6-inch platforms, they will know if their wish has been granted. This was a lie perpetuated by Sally Rees and spoken by Pip Stafford.